All right, constructing crypto castles. This is a little bit of a homecoming, I think, for us. Both Lop and I have been in the Carolinas a long time. I came to the first CryptoLina event several years ago. Learned a lot about cryptocurrency generally. Met Vitalik was there. I think this was pre all the craziness of all the Ethereum stuff. But it was a good time, since it's awesome to be back here. And thank you, Farouk, and everybody for organizing. So I'm Jeremy Welch. This is Jameson.
Hi.
And we are working on a company called Casa, which we deem as the best personal key system on the planet. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation. But to start, I think that we're going to talk a little bit about the key to surviving crypto anarchy.
And that's why we're all here. Well, this talk is probably a little bit different than most of what you've heard today. But I'm a fairly long time Bitcoin guy. Jeremy, as he said, has also been in this space for a number of years. And I've spent pretty much all of my full-time Bitcoin career dealing with security. And so we're here to tell you about our vision for crypto castles and why it's important as the world continues to change, as we believe that a lot of the sort of socioeconomic aspects of the world will change, political aspects will change, but your day-to-day lives are going to change, whether that's because of Bitcoin, Ethereum, cryptocurrency, crypto assets, blockchain, what have you. We see the entire world going towards a world where you have more control over not just your money, but many different facets of your lives. And we believe that this is mostly going to happen through the use of cryptographic keys. And you're going to need to know how to navigate this world. So we're going to talk about the ideas of crypto castles, about why we think you're going to need to be able to defend your private keys. We're going to talk about why these changes are going to affect the world at many different levels, and a lot of this is actually due to violence and the dynamics of violence. And then finally, we're going to kind of tie in Casa into all of that and why we think Casa is going to be an important part. So, what is a crypto castle? Well, let's actually go a little bit further back in time and talk about what is a castle. So early castles were mainly built out of whatever materials were available, wood, earth, other natural resources. And usually castles would be built in areas that had natural features such as water or heavily wooded areas or mountains. And it would help deter unwanted guests. And as technology improved over the centuries, attackers were going to eventually be able to overcome a lot of these natural features. And as a result, engineers changed the way that they built castles and improved the materials that they were using, eventually coming to use stone, of course, which is what we generally think of a castle as being built out of. But the dynamics of security are always in flux, and offensive and defensive technology are constantly competing, and eventually we had gunpowder come along, and the gunpowder-based weaponry was eventually able to blast through these heavy stone walls. So that ended up basically deprecating castles, making them juicy targets for artillery. And these days, if you want to defend against that type of attack, you actually have to have a heavily fortified bunker that's probably hidden well deep underground. So one of the points we're going to try to make here is that a castle is a home, and a bunker is not. A bunker is a military structure, but a castle is a fortified residence. And back in the day, when castles were really in their heyday, it was a place where you would live, you would entertain your guests, you would throw parties, you would be able to relax with the knowledge that you were safe from almost any type of attack. These days, we can look at bunkers actually like the ones that are shown right here, and over $10 billion worth of Bitcoin and presumably many other crypto assets are stored in bunkers exactly like this one, which happens to be owned by Xapo. Now, is this type of setup secure against pretty much every conceivable type of attack? Yeah. But are the users who are keeping their crypto assets stored in these bunkers sovereign unto themselves? Do they have control over their assets? Generally, no. And that's because they are entrusting these assets to the operators of the bunkers, to a trusted third party. And this is because almost nobody actually wants to live underground in one of these bunkers, cut off from the outside world. So, why is self-defense important? Well, if you're using a bunker service like Xapo, you are essentially outsourcing your defenses. Xapo is taking care of defending your private keys. But the trade-off is that you've given up control. So if you want to actually retain control of your assets, which I believe is a fundamental premise of these systems, like why Bitcoin was built in the first place, then you have to be able to take on the responsibility of defending them yourself. Now, this is something that a lot of people aren't particularly interested in. Most people, I think, don't really put a lot of time and effort into thinking about self-defense. And that's probably because they're not getting attacked that much. They're probably not a high-profile target. People who do end up having large amounts of wealth end up usually entrusting it to specialized custodians that are working on the security aspects, and that is what we're traditionally thinking of banks and other financial institutions. But if we're changing the model so that you have to defend your own assets, then most people are not living in fortified residences. They don't have a castle. At least in America, most of us are living in wooden houses that are just a few walls and doors that can be very easily breached by a motivated attacker. Now, one of the other things that really plays into the offensive and defensive scenarios here is that what we've done is we've created these digital bearer assets. And so the properties of the system that are making it very easy for you to secure and keep from having third parties take it from you are also making it very easy for the third parties who do manage to take it from you to secure it and make it impossible for you to get it back. So taking control of your assets becomes a very important aspect of this because there's no take backs if you screw up. On the other hand, there's kind of this communal immunity that I see forming here, where we're starting to see more physical attacks happen against people who are like publicly owning crypto assets. And I believe that these type of attacks are actually going to continue to accelerate as long as the attackers are successful. There are people out there who don't know about these assets, but are willing to do things in order to get them if they realize that it's very easy to get a large amount of value. So the more of us who fail to defend our assets from physical attacks and even digital attacks, I think the more that is going to invite more attackers to come into the system. So if we can show a sort of collective immunity by strengthening our defenses collectively, I think it will be good for everyone.
Now we have this question, what is the logic of violence? I think that for all of us, understanding why we're in the position and where we even need to pay attention to this is important, and we don't talk about this enough. So we're going to start with asking what this term logic of violence actually means. And logic of violence is just the payoff structure of using violence to achieve a goal. If there is a payoff, if the cost is low and the payoff or the result is high to using violence, then someone's going to use it. If, on the other hand, the cost is extremely high to use violence and the end payoff is low, they're not going to use it. So understanding the logic of violence and when it's used and why is important across the board at questions and topics of security. So how many of you have read Sovereign Individual? I'm going to jump so we like walk around a little bit. How many of you have read Sovereign Individual? Anybody? Okay, we have a few. This is a book, came out well over a decade ago. It's gotten quoted a number of times publicly around the cryptocurrency space, but it is an important read. It covers a lot around this idea of individuals using technology finally being able to become sovereign, to have more control over their lives, where historically we haven't been able to do that. But there are a few key principles in this book that are relevant to the discussion today. Namely, Naval has summarized very succinctly in a tweet storm around the core thesis with sovereign individual and some of the key principles. So here he says, the logic of violence determines the structure of society. The payoff matrix that we were talking about around whether you should use violence or not actually structures how civilization and how society is ordered. It's easier to take than create. Social structure emerges from the predator-prey relationship between makers and takers. You can start to group whole ages by this principle of looking at the logic of violence and what the logic of violence was at the given time. And there are several ages that are discussed in that book, and then were further elucidated by Naval. And I've added a couple other notes here. So a hunter-gatherer age is ruled by tribes, no land, no possessions. You're fighting with axes and spears. Agricultural age, you now have agriculture as a technology. Land and possessions emerge. It's harder to defend because you have all this in one central place. Feudal lords run protection racket, and you have a hierarchical society. It's run by kings and queens. An industrial age is ruled by a nation state, by a larger army. Vulnerable factories that are these massive production mechanisms require a consolidation of power to maintain the production process and maintain the control process, so you end up with nation states with large armies. In the nuclear age, you now have ruled by superpowers. Anybody that has a nuclear bomb gets to make some rules, right? So nuclear weapons created mutually assured destruction and large-scale peace, small-scale war. We're coming out of that age, and there is some overlap between these. But even with the whole North Korea situation, the big discussion is around them denuclearizing. That is an effect, and that is an important power piece in our current age. But now we're entering the information age. We've been there, and this age is expanding. And this brings a massive shift in both the costs and returns of violence, that logic of violence that we were talking about. In the information age, guns are easy to print. You have connected cameras that are everywhere, so you can record everything. This results in a fourth generation warfare, psychological warfare. The battle lines blur. It's not just the front lines where you end up seeing with guns and bullets and tanks, etc. You actually have psychological warfare from Russia or from any of these other countries that are attacking via Facebook or via Twitter, via bots, right? So it's a different world. You also have drones, and they change the landscape of battle in several ways, virtual reality. But the one I want to focus on here is the Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. They make it difficult to seize wealth. This is something that's never been true before in human history, is the idea that using Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, it is now possible to have much tighter control of wealth, and you have this asymmetry in terms of the power and the ability to defend your own wealth. With that, with cryptographic private keys, defending wealth is now much easier than attacking wealth. So there is an asymmetry there. But be able to use this asymmetry, you have to actually control the private keys. You also have irreversible transactions, and that further raises the stakes of what we're talking about, because if someone does gain access to your funds and they transfer your funds, you're never getting them back. We've seen numerous cases where people have had funds stolen. They end up tracking down the attacker, and they're only able to somehow get or force the reverse transfer of a small portion of the funds. Even if you find the attacker frequent times, you're not able to recover the funds. So this raises the stakes. The other piece of this is it's easy to transport funds now, but that also makes it easy to steal. So trusting a third party, even like a bank, could put you at risk, because the incentives are now such that a bank manager with access to private keys, if they're the only way that you can gain access to those funds, a bank manager with private keys can walk out of a bank and take all the client's money. And no one would know. He can do it very simply, just walk out and have it in a USB stick in his pocket. Again, this has never before happened in history that it's possible to move wealth like this. But the good news is that it's also never been possible for, or it's never been possible before in history to defend wealth like this, if you're careful. So control should be pushed to the edges. It should be in control of the users. That's how the system was defined originally, meaning that users actually manage their keys directly.
So the security landscape today is changing very quickly, but there are some things that remain generally the same. And In terms of attacks and defenses, there are a few major classes of attacks and defenses, and there's usually pretty straightforward ways that you can mitigate certain attacks. I mean, in the crypto space, getting hacked on a hot wallet is definitely the riskiest thing. So what we do in many cases is we just pull that private key data off of internet connected devices, and we either have it on a hardware device that's on the internet, or represented on paper or steel or really any type of medium that can contain the data in a fairly secure way. With physical disaster, this is something that I think not many people really think about because they're not IT folks and they don't really think about redundant storage or whatever. Social engineering is the ever-prevalent problem, and that is really one thing that requires user education and just to try to keep people from being too gullible. And then collusion is something where you would have to worry about, namely if you have trusted third parties, is that now they could potentially collude against you. So it's important to minimize trust whenever possible. So Jeremy talked a bit about the asymmetric pieces of defense and attack. And if you look just around society as we have built it today, a lot of the things we've built are quite fragile. At least in America, in modern first world countries, we tend to favor fast, disposable, cheap things over slow, robust, and expensive things. And the result is that it often ends up being far cheaper to destroy than to create. So on the left there, you see you can have a $100,000 or multi-million dollar home that could be wiped out with a single well-placed match that only costs a few pennies. Or in an even worse example, you can look at World Trade Center costs well over $1 billion in today's money to build. It was a symbol of America's economic might, but it was brought down at less than 0.1% of the cost that it took to construct it. So this is what we're talking about with the asymmetry of attack and defense. Crypto, thankfully, reverses that, and it makes defense much cheaper and attack much more expensive. So if we're thinking about this idea of crypto castles, you can actually think of air gaps as a moat, where you're taking those keys offline, and now hackers can't get across this gap. There's no internet connection for them to get to the private keys. We like to think of the strong cryptography and multi-signature aspects as the stone walls we're building foundations on top of with the applications that we're building. And then at Casa, we're using hardware key management devices as the portcullis or the gate, where even if you do get across that gap, if you don't have the PIN or the password to get into the hardware device, then you're effectively cut off at that point. And then within Casa itself, the software we're building, we're basically building management software to manage all of your crypto castle. We're building in alarms that could act like drawbridges to also yank away the ability for someone to further get into your defenses. And we are setting up various automated alerts as watchtower mechanisms that can help shut off your wallet if anyone starts to grade aspects of it. So crypto castles, we're trying to make them easier. We're trying to build homes. We're not trying to build bunkers. And we want to bring and offer the security specialization of banks without being banks ourselves. And we are leveraging the expertise that we've gained over our years in the industry, seeing many different types of attacks, many different types of failures, and we're trying to bake that all into the software itself so that our users don't have to spend days, weeks, months, years educating themselves, but rather the software will have the best practices and the education built into it.
Back to the principle you were mentioning before too, this is about community. By us helping everyone else become stronger with your own funds, we all as a community become stronger. The only way that we're gonna get out of a world to where we're dependent on massive third parties, on these massive companies or states, is by working together as a community. And so that is a really important point around, we can take some of the lessons that we learned and we wanna send them out to you, but it still requires you to do a lot of management yourself. So with that, we're gonna jump through a couple points of just what is Casa in context of this broader theme. Casa is the best personal key system on the planet. Now, why do we call it that? Well, we have an actual list. Full control, full service, minimized theft risk, accident and disaster recovery, and end-of-life transfers. If there's a system that can manage all of those things, then it's the best personal key system on the planet. This is our dream list. This is the list that we want for all of our family members and friends. And so further, the way this works is it's a multi-signature, multi-location, multi-device model. Little grayed out, can't see all of it there, but the idea here is that you have five keys. One key is stored on your phone device, one key is on a Trezor or a ledger at home, one is in a bank on a Trezor or a ledger, and one is at, say, an office or another bank on a Trezor or a ledger. And the final key is one that CASA holds that we have as an emergency recovery key because it's only one out of five, and you need three total out of the five to actually sign. We can never access your funds, we can't do anything with your account. But in the case where there was a fire that hit your home and wiped out two of your keys, or there was a theft, we would help you, we would be able to help you regenerate your full key set of five. Another important piece of this puzzle, though, is not just the actual technical capabilities of the system, it's the actual design and usability of the system. So say hello to KeyShield. This is the way that you can monitor your keys and visually understand very, very quickly whether you're at risk or not. In the middle case, it's on the far left case or the far right case, you're fully green, everything's up, all your keys are working. In the middle case, one is down, so you need to be aware. And the far case, on the red case, two of your keys are down, this is an emergency scenario, we are going to be assisting you in helping you regenerate your key shield there. Today we are live on Bitcoin Mainnet. It's a 24/7 premium service. It's $10,000 per year, mostly targeted at high net worth individuals and family offices. This is a premium price point, but the whole goal is for us to use everything we're learning in this process to then take the lessons and build products for the masses around multi-sig and around more secure management of keys. So Q2, Q3, Q4, we've got Ethereum coming, ERC20 support, CATS for all of you CryptoKitties fans, Litecoin, Zcash, Monero, Stacks, alternate key schemes, there's a lot coming. So that, we want to ask you all to start building your crypto castles. And whether you're working with us, whether you're working independently, there's lots of open source software projects around this, just start thinking about how you're going to build your crypto castle. And finally, we just have a couple, if you do want to sign up, if you want to follow us, if you ever have questions, here's some info here. And I think we're going to get into a little Q&A right now. But
okay. And we got a question. Okay. Let's start with the first one. And if we can grab the lights, you guys can go get them.
Can you talk about the end-of-life transfer? Kind of like a power of attorney built into there. And who are the banks that are already working with you all? Who are the banks that are sufficient in doing something like that, that they can hold one of the keys?
Sure. Yeah, so the way it works, so there's two questions about it there. One, the banks, and then the actual end of life. I'm going to start with the banks, because that's a quicker answer. We are not partnered directly with any one bank. You have the relationships with your bankers, with your private bankers, with your regional bank, and you open a safety deposit box. Now, normally we wouldn't recommend that you put a Trezor or a ledger, a single key, in a safety deposit box if that's the only key that's going to give you access to your funds, because that's a risk. That was one of the cases where we said that a bank manager could walk out with the funds, with the entire device, and you wouldn't be able to access it. With multi-sig, it's okay, because your keys are spread out across multiple locations. So even if one bank manager were to take one key, you would still have four other keys that you could recover with. So the answer is that you set up a safety deposit box at any of whatever your regular regional bank is. We actually don't even want to know where that bank is, what that bank is. That is actually a security risk. So we try to minimize knowledge of our customer setups as much as possible. We give you the tools, and then you would set that up. Second question is around the end of life, how that works. It works very similarly to a bank and to a safety deposit box with power of attorney. You come in, you sign the paperwork, and then we hand over the key to a spouse or to an attorney, whoever is preferred, in the case of a death certificate, end of life. Very similar process to how you get access to funds or a safety deposit box at end of life.
Yeah, when we say bank, we just mean secure location. It could very easily mean, trusted friend or family.
Okay, got another question right here.
What do you guys think about building castles around the exchanges, which are, you know, huge security risk?
So, you know, I worked at BitGo for 3 years doing back-end development, and BitGo was primarily servicing exchanges. And exchanges have one of the greatest challenges of anyone in this space, because they have to operate automated hot wallets. So really what you have to do there is just a lot of risk management, which mainly is going to involve keeping the vast majority of those funds offline. Keeping them in a CASA-like solution with multi-sig and multiple devices in multiple locations is the way to go. And then managing the hot wallets themselves, though, is an entire other ball of yarn, which we are not trying to address with this specific product. We, you know, someday anticipate also having various hot wallets that will, you know, be hardware backed, but these are very different classes of problems, and the solution that we're putting out right now would be best used for the cold storage side.
Yeah, there are some excellent companies that specialize in securing exchanges like BitGo. That if, you know, if that is the end goal, it's best to speak with one of those companies. Our specific solution and all of our designs are created for the end user, for the end consumer, to create the easiest system for, again, you to build your own crypto castle around your personal home.
Okay. Anybody can raise their hand? Any other questions? All right, we got another one back here.
So with the app, there's like a circle and five, you know, if one of your keys was, I guess, in danger or whatever. Yeah. But if they're offline in cold storage, how does that know if one is offline?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the answer there is that only two of those keys are technically going to be accessible to some level of computers, and that's going to be the one that's on your phone, or to network access. So it's the one on your phone, and then the one that would be on our servers, signed by CASA's servers. On those two, we can access, or we can test uptime. On the other three, there are regular checks, so we ping you to do regular checks on your own devices. That's nothing that we see. You go to your specific locations, and once a month or once a quarter, you'll pick whatever, it may be once a week if you want. You will go to that location, you'll sign with the device, you'll make sure it's working. One thing a lot of people are not aware of right now or not thinking about is what's called bit rot. So how many of you have had an iPhone or another device that just crapped out, just stopped working? Right. Now think about storing $500K, $1 million, $2 million on a single device and then having the same problem, right? Trezor and Ledger, they're both phenomenal products, but these are just the realities of building electronics. And so what we're trying to do is create an automated system so that you can go through and test your hardware devices regularly. And then if you do have a problem, it's easy to flag the device in the app. And then we can help you get a new device, set it up fast. We are all about rapid response. That's why it's 24/7 service. That's why it's expensive, right? Is it is 24/7. If you call us, we're going to answer in two or three rings. It's not going into a queue. You have a direct rep, right? But the idea there is that you, for the offline pieces, you are going to have to do some radio testing yourself. We can just help you with tracking that, logging that, and seeing, you know, any weaknesses in the process.
That's basically what we're talking about when we're saying, you know, taking best practices and actually putting them into the software so that it's not that the user has to understand all of these things. It's that we're going to nag you if you're not following the best practices.
Okay, we got one last question there, and then I know everybody, we've got two quick announcements, but right before our last question. Somebody did lose a tan wallet, so if you found it, please see the office on the stairs. Tan wallet, if you found one, please let us know. And then on your way out, you'll be able to pick up your drink tickets and the bar is actually open. So, last question.
So, I guess one of the questions with the system is, what would you consider to be the weakest link within it? And would you suggest using something such as 2FA and also a custodian as well as a way to kind of help to strengthen the system for the individual, providing more comfort with utilizing CASA?
The weakest link is always going to be the humans, because even within a system like this where we're providing a lot of guidance, we can't force the user to do anything. The user could do something stupid and put all of their devices in one location, and then some sort of catastrophe happens or theft happens. and there's nothing we can do. So there are always going to be potential loss scenarios, especially if the user is not following guidance. But this is also another reason why this is starting out as a more boutique solution, is that, you know, we are basically holding the user's hands as much as possible and trying to guide them in the right direction. But at the end of the day, we can't force anyone to do anything.
This is also why we're talking about self-defense, why we're talking about self-responsibility, right? We think that in the early days of the Bitcoin space, cryptocurrency space, a lot of companies bypass the personal responsibility angle, and rightly so, because people were just learning about these technologies. But now that people know about them, we need to push to the edge of maximum control, maximum security, and really understanding the real risks. Anybody that tells you that another solution doesn't have risks is lying to you. It's all a question of kind of where the control is. And so we're trying to put the most control in the hands of the end user while providing maximum support, 24/7 support, good design, great products to assist you in running your life and building your crypto castle and operating it, right? But the reality is that there are always going to be risks. The best we can do is give you all the best practices so that you're personally prepared.
And you did ask about 2FA, and while we're not supporting like TOTP or UTF 2FA, the phone app itself will support biometric, like fingerprint authentication for the sensitive actions. But really, the most important aspect of all of this is having geographically separated hardware devices, and each of those hardware devices requires a PIN. So that is kind of another 2FA on its own.
And I'm going to make one last recommendation as we wrap up with that in mind, is everyone here should call their telecom company, Verizon, AT&T, whoever it is, and ask them to change your account so that it requires you to come into the actual office with three forms of ID, not two, but three forms of ID, and also specify a specific office close to your house or at least within your city. The reason why we're suggesting this, you were asked about 2FA, so I wanted to point this out, is that there was, or for a while, a lot of systems were using a text message-based system where they would send you a second factor code that you would give you a text message. We're now seeing a ton. This is not all public. We see a lot of them privately. I just saw another one last week where someone internally is somehow infiltrating some of these telecom companies and is systematically going through and swapping out phone numbers. They swap your phone, they log into your Gmail, they get access, and then they start trying to hit all of your exchange accounts, hot wallets, all kinds of stuff, even like Amazon accounts, bank accounts, anything. The way to protect yourself is to move off of text message based, kind of two-factor auth. But the other way to protect yourself to prevent the phone number transfers in general is to ask for this kind of three ID setup. And we're recommending that to everyone to do that because we've seen it. We keep seeing it across the board. And people thought they were protected even by two IDs. People have shown up in person with two IDs, with fake IDs, and still managed to move their phone number. So,
but you still should not trust the phone company anyway because they can still collude against you. So, at the end of the day, no one is fully safe.
Okay. Awesome. Next time for you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, guys.